I'm Kate Newey from the Drama Department. I'm something of a gatecrasher here, but Lee has asked me to introduce Caroline Evans, our next speaker, who's the professor, it's a wonderful title, Professor of Fashion History and Theory at St Martin's, which is now part of the Liberal Arts London, although she's originally, and still is, an art historian and cultural historian. She's just published, I think it's wonderful to celebrate books that have just come out, her latest book called The Mechanical Smile, Modernism and the First Fashion Shows in France and America, 1900 to 1929. So she's going to speak to us now about factories of elegance, 20th century French haute couture.
Thank you very much. I managed to bring my wrong glasses, so I'm going to read this at long distance. So I always have this problem with my distances. So my paper brings us from the 19th century into the early 20th, and also from the UK to France, and by extension to the UK. It's taken from a chapter of the book that came out last week, which is really about the first fashion shows and modernism, but it's also about the commercial and the cultural relations in the garment industry between France and America, for which the fashion show, and sometimes the figure of the fashion model or mannequin, as she's called, becomes a kind of fulcrum. So I'll make some references to that, but I was going to talk mainly about space and production, specifically mostly about an album of photographs in the National Art Library in London, which, in fact, I'll show you a picture from it. And the album comprehensively documents the House of Worth in Paris over 2 days in November 1927. And this image of seamstresses in a couture atelier, which I'll go on to talk about, is one of those images. So on the face of it, the album is a kind of archive of the working practices and the business spaces of couture production. And that in itself is interesting enough, and I'll show you some of the 50-odd images, photographs from the album today. But I also want to argue that the album is not simply or not merely a record, but also a kind of representation. A representation of what Walter Benjamin called the optical unconscious in his 1931 essay on photography. And he describes there how photography of modern scenes can afford us what he calls an optical unconscious. And he's writing about the sort of chronophotography of, from the 1880s of people like the British-American photographer Edward Muybridge, and the French physiologist Étienne Marais. You may know those images of running men and women and horses. And so those images of moving figures reveal the gap between animal locomotion and our perception. So for Benjamin, it's as if photography itself is a kind of lens through which to glimpse a vision of modernity invisible to the naked eye in a rapidly changing world. So Benjamin writes that photography, with its devices of slow motion and enlargement, reveals what he calls the secret of modern life. And the 50-odd images in the Worth album, while not literally using such devices, nevertheless, I'd like to suggest, constitute a kind of slow motion and enlargement of the business protocols, as well as the production methods of the couture trade. But if the album has an optical unconscious, what does it show? Well, it shows a number of hidden features of the couture trade, that is, features that the trade itself prefers to keep quiet about. In particular, I think the usually obscured relationship of Parisian luxury fashion with international trade and mass manufacturing is the underlying bedrock of the fashion show, which I write about at more length in the book and its scenography. But my talk today looks more specifically at the role of interior design within that bigger picture. So I want to try to trace a link between the interior decoration and disposition of the couture house and its business structure. And the album itself is a kind of contradiction in that sense, because it hints at what is normally kept concealed by the trade itself, by Parisian haute couture and its sort of publicity machine. And that is the commercial and trade links of an industry that pretended to be only an elite luxury industry, when in fact it sold primarily to buyers and mass market manufacturers worldwide. So perhaps it's really the couture house rather than the album that's the kind of optical unconscious of the French fashion trade, with all its contradictions and its tendencies towards mystification. So I want to argue that the architectural spaces of French couture houses mirrored their commercial structure from as early as the mid-19th century, when the commercial structures of French haute couture itself were being established. And although it's really a type of doing business that begins in the mid-19th century, those 19th century protocols live on into the 20th century, even in houses sort of, you know, mass sort of worldwide luxury labels like Chanel. They still live on into the 20th century, and in a few cases, their interiors survive today as a reminder of the activities they witnessed in the past. So if we start with a modern-day real space at Chanel as a prelude to those spaces of 1927 that I want to come back to, here is the house that's in the Rue Cambon in Paris. The new collections are still made in the old ateliers on the upper stories. There's a painted sign on the third floor design studio, still remaining from the days when Coco Chanel herself worked there, so it says in French, Mademoiselle Private. And if we go into the interior, unaltered also are the mirrored staircase and the mirrored panel on the second floor landing that opens onto the apartment where during the daytime Chanel S saw friends, met journalists and worked when not in the studio. So that's her in the apartment. That's her with her Coromandel screens, and they're still, the apartment's still there today, it's preserved. So there, her decor, her knick-knacks, her screens are preserved, and on the first floor of the house itself, below this apartment, there is still the grand modelling salon in which the early fashion shows took place. And although the room's been altered, of course it retains its proportions, if not its original decor. This is the staircase then, and now it does still exist, which you may have seen in films. So the staircase leads up from that first floor salon to the second floor. When Chanel was alive, you can see, oh, she's not in this picture, but anyway, there are pictures of her sitting on the upstairs landing looking down at the shows on the first floor. So Chanel established her firm in these premises in 1921, and she extensively refurbished them over three floors in 1928. And the reason I'm showing you all of this is because I want to think about the idea from the French historian Pierre Nora of places of memory, because I think it's a sort of quintessential place of memory in the sense that Nora uses it in his very, if you like, magisterial survey of French couture, French culture and identity. Nora's book is called Lieux de mémoire, translated as Realms of Memory, Rethinking the French Past. And in his foreword to the first volume, Lawrence Kritzman observes that Nora's project is, I quote, an attempt to read the signs of culture in places, objects, and images that are marked by the past and remembered in the vicissitudes of contemporary consciousness. And Nora himself, in his preface to the English language edition, described his original motivation to study national feeling not, as he writes, in the traditional thematic or chronological manner, but instead by analysing the places in which the collective heritage of France was crystallised, the principal lieu, in all the senses of the word, in which collective memory was rooted in order, he wants to create a vast topology of French symbolism. But the important point I want to take from Nora, not so much the big French history, but the idea of these lieux, which are not literally spaces or not necessarily, they are, which is why they're translated as realms. He writes they could be places, sites, or causes that are material, symbolic, and functional. In fact, all the characteristics of a Parisian couture house. Far from grandiose, however, these lieux or realms of memory may also be marginal and fragmented, and Nora found them where what he called the milieu de mémoire were gone and little else remained. So a lieu de mémoire needn't survive as a physical space or even an object, he cites, I think, railway timetables, but it could be something like the Worth photographic album, just as much a realm of memory as the physical space of the couture house. So if the surviving house of Chanel is one such site of memory, another one is this photographic album. And it's an approach which I think is particularly fruitful for the fashion historian, who often finds that despite the symbolic capital of French capital, many of its material traces and business records have disappeared, or they're so scant as not to be terribly useful. So, here's the Worth album, with the perfume van and the chauffeur. So, the album shows both spaces and gestures, to take two terms from Nora. He writes about images, objects, spaces, and gestures. It shows the interior arrangement and disposition of its rooms and their population by the entire workforce, from cooks to mannequins, seamstresses to office workers, the director of the firm to this chauffeur in the perfume van. The album starts, this is the boutique on the ground floor. The album starts with the salon's front of house and the boutique, and it gradually moves backstage to record the spaces and activities of the workrooms, studios, stores, and offices. And there are no records to suggest why or how the album came into being. It's a very high quality production, if you like, in terms of the photography. But it appears to have been made with the full consent of the house, and it constitutes an unusually thorough documentation of its activities. So its coverage of all aspects of a working couture firm, so much at odds with the publicist's version of haute couture, suggests that it was probably made as an internal record and not for public dissemination. That doesn't, however, mean that it's in any sense a snapshot, because, as is the case with all photography in those days, the images are very much staged, even when they're meant to be a sort of slice of life. So this, for example, is a representation of a client going up in the lift, but we don't know if this really was a client. With most of these couture interiors, I think that the staff usually are playing the roles of customers. So one has to understand the sort of level of constructiveness in what nowadays would be called a sort of reportage photography. Is very different in that period from how we think of it now. So here's a client having a fitting with a saleswoman. So the photographs in their entirety exemplify the way in which, as Nora suggests, images are important historical sources that, you have to remember he's writing in the 80s, that a previous generation might have disregarded. He wrote then, "As is an intensely retinal and powerfully televisual memory," this is pre-internet, "we can link the acclaimed return of narrative evident in recent historical writing and the omnipotence of imagery and cinema in contemporary culture." But I think still of relevance is the fact that Nora linked the usage of the archival fragments, such as these images from the Worth archive, that are unanchored by any written documentation, to the fragmented experience of life today. So he argues that the fragment feels more real as a mode of history writing. And he describes the archive as consisting of fragments that he says are shards of the past delivered to us by so many micro-histories. And again, it's the idea of the micro-histories, or the sort of fragmented nature of the micro-history, that might still perhaps be useful. So the House of Worth closed in 1956, and its interior no longer survives. But what the micro-history of this Worth album reveals is the extensive backstage life of an industry that only ever promoted its front-of-house activities and was often extremely secretive about life behind the scenes. And that's why I'm going to focus on the behind-the-scenes images today. The difference between the two runs was immense, and the sort of fulcrum between them, as I've said, was the fashion show. So, for example, here you have a scene of fashion models. I'm going to say mannequins because that was the term used then, and it's the term I use in the book, but that means living women that we today call fashion models, because the model is actually the model dress, and it's an industrial term. So when I say mannequins, I mean these alive women. So here you have a scene of modeling in the couture house salon. Here you have a scene of a mannequin modeling to two clients, and you can see the mannequins waiting to come on. And also notice these mirrors facing each other, because I'm going to end by talking about mirrors and the sort of replication of the image in the mirror. And then the next picture is sort of from the other side. We've gone backstage, and there's the dressing room, there's the mannequin being dressed to come on, and these two mannequins waiting in the corridor to go on and model to the clients. So that's the kind of setup. And it's very important that this moment of crossover from backstage to front of house is, as anthropologists would say, a liminal space, and very few people are permitted to cross it. Mannequins are, in that sense, have a special status. So I want to go on to think about, try to show with examples, how, in order to understand both these spaces and the couture trade itself, you have to pay careful attention to the metaphor used by contemporary written sources, by which I mean mostly fashion journalism, books about fashion and reportage. So I've got texts which have sort of equal valence to images that we're going to be looking at. Writers in this period repeatedly use two metaphors to describe front of house and behind the scenes. So front of house is the stage and backstage is the factory, and that's what I want to focus on. But of course, there are tons of fashion illustrations, you know, with stage metaphors showing fashion mannequins modelling. So, for example, going straight to the backstage factory metaphor, as one journalist wrote in 1901 of Redfern's five-story couture firm in Paris in the Rue de la Paix, "I assure you that it is unbelievable how much there is in this factory, for it is a veritable factory of elegance." And many, many commentators pursued the industrial metaphor in describing the role of the modern couturier, like this 1923 quote here on the right. So the haute couturier, who is an artist, must also be a company director, a bank manager, and a factory owner. In fact, I think it had always been the case since the late 19th century, despite the promotional rhetoric of couture in this period, which argues that it's, you know, it's not like the good old days when they could be artists. Today they have to be businessmen. But in reality, they always were businessmen. So here you have a slightly balding, back to the album, a slightly balding Jean-Charles Wirth, who was director of the firm in 1927, and indeed he's photographed in that way, seated at his desk rather than in the design studio. And on the wall opposite to him is a very well-known photograph of his great-grandfather, Charles Frederick Wirth, the illustrious founder of the firm, wearing the Rembrandt beret that he wore in later life to suggest, as Nancy Troy argues, a sort of promotional strategy whereby he tried to pass himself off as an artist and his business as artistry. And she Troy argues that the beret and the whole self-presentation is very much part of that package. By contrast, Jean-Charles is photographed here as a businessman. He's deep in his paperwork, exactly like the description by Paul Reboux in his 1927 book on couture. I can't remember if I've got this as a slide. Yes. So, formerly the head of a great couture firm with a man used to handling fabrics and design garments, today he's much more of a businessman. So instead of being an artist surrounded by samples, etc., creating beauty with fairy tale ease, an idea we're going to come back to because it's very much the language of fairy tales that is used to describe this backstage production, is no more than a slightly bald administrator in pince-nez installed in his office and surrounded by tariffs. Which, of course, if you go back to poor old Jean-Charles, he is a bit balding. Reboux says this is a modern phenomenon, but as I've already suggested, it really wasn't. In the 19th century, as haute couture became an important export business, the couture houses grew in size, and their organization had to become larger, more bureaucratic, and their labor had to be more divided and specialized. Well, it didn't have to be, but that was the commercial argument. And it's that system, still in place in 1927, that the Wirth album shows in such detail. And its main characteristic was the atelier system, which I'll try and explain through looking at the pictures. So the atelier, which just means workroom, was a kind of organic, semi-autonomous cell, repeated 10 to 15 times throughout the house. There were different ateliers, often several floors apart, for different functions. So for cutting out patterns, for sewing skirts, bodices, sleeves, for tailoring, drapery, another one, for embroidery and trimmings, for sketching. These are the sketchers up top under the roof, so they've got the daylight coming in for their sketches. And in the basement, you have the racking atelier, so for packaging up the goods that are going to be sold out. And you've also got bureaucratic offices, you know, that produce the paperwork that is needed to accompany. So you can begin to see what a huge backstage production it is. And different aspects of the work were kept strictly segregated in different parts of the building. So it was the job of the arpette, or the errand girls, many of them as young as 12, to ferry dockets, samples, goods and pattern pieces between the different rooms. They were rather like a human conveyor belt as they scurried between the rooms. The workforce was not allowed to move by and large. Here's the telephonist taking calls. And here is the furrier's atelier, staffed by men in this case. Most of the staff are women. But note, really crucially, the clerk on the left-hand side, who is logging the in and out of it all. And every single movement of anything and everything, samples, goods, whatever, was logged, literally, as it left or entered a room. So it's a slightly crazy endeavour, actually. All fabrics are carefully logged, and it's partly to do with the scale of the thing, because if you make a mistake when you're a really small enterprise, it doesn't matter, but if you multiply that by enormous numbers because you're a huge enterprise, then it has a big economic effect if you've made a mistake or if someone's pilfering. So here again, here's a stock room, and again you can see the man, the male and the female clerks are sort of logging the goings on in their ledgers. So they process the payments, the ins and outs, and here's the administration, the office, and in the offices, records are kept of the manufacturing costs of every single dress. That includes material and labour, and they're all recorded in a ledger, alongside, if it's for a private client, all the client's personal details. Alexandre, in his book, calls the ledgers the books, the couture house's books of heraldry. The staff at in-house, that's another administration office, and I actually really like it for the sort of modernity of this young woman with her shingled hair and her very tailored suit, and very sort of, to us, I think, very sort of elegant look. So there's a kind of modern young businesswoman. This is the refectory for the seamstresses. There are different refectories for the office staff, the office workers, and for the seamstresses. So this is a much poorer one. If you look what's on the table, and I'll show you the office workers in a second. Staff at in-house, albeit poorly, there were so many employees that, depending on the size of the house, meals were taken in either anything between 2 and 5 separate sittings. So you had a half-hour lunch period. You can see the office workers. So they've got tablecloths. It's actually not about whether you have wine or not or something, which we might think is more important. It's actually about whether you have bread, mm-hmm. And also, obviously, tablecloths and better cutlery. But there were really bitter labour disputes in the garment industry in France in this period. And although, I mean, the being given lunch at work was a hard one, right, but actually most of the complaints were that it you didn't actually get enough, so you had to supplement it with your own income by bringing food in. And then downstairs you've got the kitchen. These are the guys making the lunches for everyone. So if we go back to the ateliers that all those lunches are meant to fuel. There's an example. So in the ateliers, each garment part, skirts, bodices and sleeves, are made by different specially trained seamstresses, and they're named after their function. So they're called jupier, corsagier or manchier, literally skirt maker, bodice maker or sleeve maker. Other specialist workers make only buttonholes or trimmings, and every atelier has a strict internal hierarchy with a premier who might be in charge of as many as 30 to 40 women below her. And so specialised were couture apprenticeships that by the age of 16, a girl could be a fully trained skirt maker, bodice maker, or even sleeve maker. Have a look at how young looking that girl is in the foreground. She's an apprentice, obviously, training. But the point was, although they acquired these very specialist skills at a high level, no single worker ever acquired the knowledge or the skills to create an entire dress, nor did she ever move between ateliers. So it's a sort of proto-Fordist kind of method of construction, if you think about it. You know, it's rather like one man making the same wheel arch all day long, rather than one man taking 3 days to kind of carefully craft and put together a car. And this is a 19th century way of working, late 19th century. So it precedes sort of both Fordism and Taylorism by several decades. So each atelier has a première, who's the woman in charge of all the seamstresses. And the, as I've said, the dress parts were moved from room to room by the apprentices, the appet, and worked on separately. So only a very, very few employees would ever see the completed dress. And this strict division of labour not only facilitated production, but it also militated against staff piracy. As I said, it anticipated Henry Ford's first moving assembly line by some decades, and it suggests an industrial model of production, even though the individual craft skills required in each atelier were of a very high level sometimes. And there's an economic reason for that too, because in France, handmaking was much cheaper than machine making in many instances. It actually costs a lot to tool up, and it happens much later in the garment industry than in other industries. And it happens, you know, much earlier in America than it does in Europe, and not until quite into the 20th century. But coming back to the couture house, the use of human cogs in the form of the apprentices who move between the atelier and the strict division of labour between the ateliers suggests not only Fordism, but also a kind of Taylorist efficiency, even before Taylorism became popular in France. And I suppose that was the idea I had in, you know, in mind when I was looking at your material. I thought, oh, there's something similar going on here in thinking. So contemporary writers describe the couture house as a somewhat sinister organism, at once lifelike and deathly. Mechanical, huge, and trundling, the couture house seemed to them to have a life of its own, and yet to be composed of human parts, each person functioning as a tiny cog in an enormous machine. So when journalists and critics visited the backstage areas, they frequently used the language of popular melodrama to describe it. And in this respect, popular journalism becomes a significant source for a certain kind of cultural imaginary, because these descriptions give colourful, sort of folkloric descriptions of Taylorism or proto-Taylorism, couched in the language of fairy tales and other fictions, particularly French popular theatre, actually. So, for example, Arsène Alexandre, in his book of 1902, repeats the trope that, you know, the buyer or the client at the show sees nothing of the backstage activity and she only knows her mannequin and her saleswoman. And he goes further to describe how, he says, where the private client allowed backstage at the moment when all the parts of the dress are magically assembled, like a dismembered enchanter in a fairy story putting himself back together, the client would admire the mathematical way in which this great machine with 1,500 arms, that's the workers, was regulated to complete as complex an operation as the execution of a costume or dress. So in this description of couture production, the house becomes a kind of human machine powered by arm movements, and the figure of a woman is dismembered and spread through its workrooms in the form of the garment pieces, the sleeves, the bodices, and the skirts that I talked about before. And so that in turn recalls the linguistic connection between those dress parts and their makers, the skirt maker, bodice maker, and sleeve maker. So in the hands of these workers, the body in production is fragmented in these descriptions, and here Arsène Alexandre maps the parts onto the workspaces of the house, the specialist ateliers that make the different dress parts. And only at the moment of potential consumption does it all come together. The body is made whole again when the dress is ready to be modelled to the client. So Alexandre's account suggests a form of commodity fetishism in which organic and mechanical movement have switched, so that the living mannequin resembles the inanimate mannequin, the dummy, from which she takes her name, while the uncanny house, maison de couture, which is really a house but not a home, it becomes a sort of machine or an organism with between 1,400 or 6,000 human arms. So the house is animated only because the human workers have become mechanical, with their divided and regulated labour dispersed through its ateliers. In this imagery, the couture house, or firm, is pictured as a body, in the sense discussed by the sociologist John O'Neill, who argues that the capacity of individuals and social groups to think anthropomorphically allows them to think bodies, as he calls it, through society, and simultaneously to think society through bodies. So for O'Neill, the body of consumer culture can't be separated from the body politic, or from the economy that both creates its appetite and sometimes feeds them. Because, he writes, commodities are good for thinking as well as good for consuming. So in the early 20th century couture house, a place of both production and sales, bodies and commodities here appeared to exchange characteristics as the body itself was mapped onto the house through backstage production. So here we go back to a fitting on a mannequin in the silk storeroom. If the house itself was pictured as uncanny, so too were its inhabitants, the mannequins on whom the dresses were designed, cut in the weeks leading up to the collections. Then the mannequins would be employed as what today are called fit models, standing for long hours while dresses were fitted on them, as here. And here's a mannequin being dressed in a cabine. Again, in contemporary accounts, the language of fairy tales and popular melodrama powerfully describes the magical operations of capital as the mannequins were fitted in this cabine. So Louis Hugo, I think I heard, yes, describes the cabine as just their room where they get dressed. He describes how the mannequins gave life to the dresses. In the cabine, 20 living bodies multiplied in the mirrors will lend the inert dresses the movements of their hips, the breath in their chests, the beating of their hearts. And Georges Lefebvre describes how towards the end of the month, coming up towards the season for showing, the first 12, the prototypes in unbleached calico, start to come downstairs from the atelier. He says they're viewed on living mannequins, but these phantoms need animating. He means because they come down in unbleached calico, so they look like ghosts, but they need animating by being made in real colour and fabric. But there's an ambiguity because about what needs animating, whether it's the living woman or the dress, and there's always that ambiguity between the two. So he writes next that the monochrome vision must be brought to life by choosing fabrics and trimmings for the dress. And it's not only the costumes, but also the mannequins who came to life over a month. From the endless hours of standing still as dummies in the ateliers while garments were pinned, cut and altered on them, they progressed to the fluid and professional modelling techniques they employed in the salons at showtime. So Lefebvre describes the tense moment before the show, with all the buyers waiting expectantly in the salon. The door to the mannequin's cabine remains closed, he writes. On the one side, the chatter and the cigar smoke intensifies, that's front of house. On the other, Ginette is looking for her lipstick and powder puff. Her colleagues push her gently by the shoulders. The door opens. The mannequin slowly descends the three marble steps. And he writes, there is total brusque silence. A big buyer from Cleveland takes his cigar out of his mouth and murmurs, lovely. And Lefebvre's comment is, the dress is born. So the dress that started life dispersed through the ateliers in bits and pieces finally comes to life in the gaze of the buyer and through his approbation. Many commentators, including Alexandre Roubaud, Roger Millès and Lefebvre, all used this fairy tale language and uncanny imagery to discuss the way the dress is called into existence. Ghostly twirls require animation, dress parts are magically assembled, and the final vision and kaleidoscopic sensation eclipses the long, hard task of making the dress. So the dress was no sooner born, in this sense, than it began to multiply again, and that's what I want to end up by talking about. So Hugo described it as this dress which within a few weeks had had 1,000 existences among 1,000 distant young women in America. So the point is, after the important buyer from Cleveland places his order, the dress then becomes the foundation for the manufacture of hundreds and even thousands of copies in American factories, because what the buyers are buying is not goods, but design ideas. They're buying a prototype, they're then going to massively simplify, quite often pick apart, divide, sort of recreate the 10 different dresses, do trades between each other, and then put them into production in American factories, and it's mass. At this period, you're in a period of automated mass production in America. So that's the relationship that's being articulated between the one-off sort of couture model and its mass production as both image and object in the factories of America and many other, Europe as well, in fact, and South America as well as North. As another French analyst, Pierre Gerbet, described the fashion show in 1932, the show opens a floodgate to the world. He writes, it is an event that sets in motion 1,000 pencils, 1,000 languages. It gives flight to 1,000 cables and feeds 1,000 headlines. Berlin, New York, London and Rome await what Paris has authorized. So this is hyperbole, of course, But it's not only hyperbole, because the scale of multiplication was huge. So when an American dressmaker imported 40 models, each one's partially unpicked, it provides the pattern for 25 more models that are then replicated in their hundreds and thousands. So one model in dress sold in Paris can become 100 mass manufactured in New York. And if you think that the biggest Parisian houses produce 700 model dresses a season, you get an idea of the scale of multiplication. And that's what another fashion journalist in the period called the arithmetic of fashion. And I want to end, really, by arguing that it's this arithmetic that is set out, pictorialized, if you like, in the mirrored walls of the salons as a kind of optical unconscious. So this is a much more interesting photograph than it looks. Here's the fashion model coming into the salon, the saleswoman. What you have is, this is what is called an enfilade, a series of receding doorways or openings on the same axis. Next to this real space enfilade, you have the space mimicked in the mirrors, which have exactly the same framing, but it's mirrored. So because you've got two mirrors opposite each other, you've got an illusion of infinite recession of space. At the same time, you've got mirrored panels between the windows that, due to some complicated zigzaggery thing that I can't quite work out, means that in essence you see the figure of the mannequin who's come into the room as an image before the real woman has come into the room. So you have a very complex spatial organization and kind of plays with mirrors, and often a kind of duplicity in which the mirror will mimic either real space or there'll be ambiguities between clear glass and mirrored glass. So although they look like very sort of classical, contained, orthodox interiors, they're very sophisticated in terms of the visual games that can be played with the mirrors. It's easier to see it in a fashion illustration like this one, where you get one model turned into a sort of fashion show by the infinite reflection, regression in the mirror, which obviously you achieve by mirrors opposite to each other. And I just put this in to remind you, because I said at the beginning, bear in mind the mirrors. And you've seen that picture before. So the sort of times tables of production and sales are pictured in the couture salon by the multiplication of the mannequin's image in all these mirrored walls. I'm almost done. So it's a kind of production line of individuated luxury consumption, as Krakauer might have said, a sort of luxury to excess to the nth degree. And here in the line of mirrored images, for example, on the left-hand side, is a series of what Madeleine Vionnet was to call repeated originals, to describe, a sort of oxymoron, obviously, to describe the dresses that she licensed for sale in the USA in the 1920s, all the while pretending to be a very exclusive elite couturier. So if backstage production was about manufacturing dresses, front-of-house production is about manufacturing bodies or images of bodies. The backstage regulation that I've described in the atelier system extended to the mannequin's performance front-of-house too, where her repetitive and stylized gestures in the show incorporated her as a living part of the machinery of the couture house, a huge coordinated mansion of regulated and divided labor, just as the calibrated and standardized movement of the tailorist worker made him a mere cog in the scientific management of the workplace. In 1928, a year after the images I've shown you from the Worth album, Chanel went one stage further and she installed an entirely mirrored modeling salon. So most of this image is a reflection, but you can see, obviously this is the image of what's actually here, but you can see the way the chairs are organized with an aisle down the middle, and that's where the shows would be held. And the models came in from, it's off the picture over there from there on. But there's also this mirrored staircase that I'll show you some more of, and there are some fashion shows in which they come down the mirrored staircase. So you can imagine the effect of the sort of multiplication on this scale of the images of the fashion models in motion. Yes, sorry. So let's have a look at the fact of the... So this is again from a film. This is from the late 30s. And the only real figure, and this is all reflection, this image, apart from this woman here in the corner. And it's a really beautiful, beguiling piece of footage because it's like a sort of kaleidoscope made out of human figures. And the reason it's so fractured is because the angle of the mirrors is very wide because it's a drum. And it's the walls are lined with long strips of mirrors, so they're a very wide angle. And so it throws off this completely perplexing but very beguiling kind of pattern, I suppose, of moving bodies in space, which are, of course, the dresses for sale. So both at Worth and Chanel, the multiplied images of the living mannequin provided a set of metaphorical stills capable of constituting an optical unconscious that revealed or pictured a set of contradictions about the copy and the original within the industry itself, because the supposed original is what's modelled in the show, and the copy, of course, is what's made in the American factories. And Nancy Troy has written very eloquently on the complexities and the contradictions of the idea of the original and the copy in fashion in this period. But I also would like to end by, I mean, having suggested that the mirrors give you a kind of optical unconscious of the backstage operations that somehow have to be occluded in the front of house publicity machine, I want to end also just briefly by thinking about what isn't there as much as what is. So what you see here, going back to the album on the left, you can see the salon that I showed you. But on the right is, I'm afraid, a poor quality reproduction of an illustration from American Vogue of 1923 that shows the American buyers at work at a fashion show. So all these men here, and women as well, because there were women, are the buyers from the Art Market New York stores. And it's funny that the buyers are the only people that the Worth album doesn't show. And that absence, I think, is perhaps the biggest sort of optical unconscious in the album, and it's a reminder to us as researchers, I think, to look as closely at what is not there as we do at what is there. And what an irony that American Vogue shows these buyers in 1923 when the Worth album doesn't, because the buyers are the linchpin of the business. So the principal contradiction within the French couture business revolves around the model dress. And before Worth's innovations in the 1850s, a dress would be individually made for each client in consultation with her. Worth not only instituted the idea of the pre-designed collection, but he also sold it to overseas buyers to Paris before the private clients ever saw it. The overseas buyers were much more important than the private clients. The private client, however, was never to know this. And mimicking the aristocratic decor of the Hôtel Particulier, the modelling salon gave no clue to the hive of industry that lay behind it, which I've tried to show you today. In order to promote itself as a top-end, craft-based luxury trade, the French couture had to disguise its commercial links, and to some extent, its promotion was built on a lie. It claimed the high ground of French culture through its sale of luxurious one-offs, but it depended for its lifeblood on selling twirl and patterns worldwide for mass production by foreign industries. And this structure of doubling was disavowed in couture rhetoric, yet built into the couture industry. So the relationship between copy and original was replicated in the forms of doubling and differentiation of the image that shuffled between model to mannequin to client in the fashion show and in the mirrored walls that surrounded it. So the unique model worn by the Paris mannequin became serial in the mirrored walls of the couture house, as if to picture future sales and American production, à la répétition, as mass-produced clothing was called in French. So this visualization of knowledge was further replicated in the architecture and business organization of the house, with a living mannequin in the fashion show functioning as the fulcrum between backstage production and front-of-house sales. And I've got a long quote, but I think we should move on to questions, so I'll just zip through it. But going back to John O'Neill, in his book Five Bodies, he talks about this idea of the productive body, and I really just wanted to argue that the mannequin is just one such productive body that sort of, he gives lots of examples, and then at the end he says, through fashion and cosmetics. But let me just show you the last picture and perhaps try and make that point in simpler language. We can go back to that if you want. This is actually a film still from Doucet, from a newsreel in 1923. I think another kind of optical unconscious, the moving image that is slowed down here into stasis. And this also is a very unusual piece of film because it shows these probably American buyers on the left-hand side.
So it's a still frame from this rapidly moving image of what O'Neill calls every technique of the body in a unified field of production and consumption, and therefore, he writes, a productive body as an extension of the economy, a body which, to end by quoting him, is reified into, he writes, productive sectors concerned with its own production and consumption and integrated... productive sectors concerned with its own production and consumption that integrate and redistribute the body through the social division of labour.